Hi, I'm Edward from Supermetrics, and this is the Marketing Intelligence Show, the podcast that empowers marketing leaders to work better with their data and make sure every marketing dollar counts. Now let's get into today's episode.
Hey there, and welcome back to another episode of the Marketing Intelligence Show. My name's Evan, and I'm the lead solutions engineer here at Supermetrics. In today's episode, we'll be talking to Andrew Cavado. Andrew is the founder and managing director of Growth by Science, a company that helps brands focus on their media buying efforts and their marketing measurement effectiveness. Andrew's held a number of roles at notable companies, Meta, Google, eBay, Netflix, and at one point was the global head of measurement at Snap. In today's episode, we'll be talking about some of the pitfalls associated with platform-reported conversions and how tools like incrementality and marketing mix modeling, or MMM, can help supplement marketers' measurement strategies to help provide a clearer view of the actual contribution of marketing. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining the show. Welcome. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is Andrew Cavado. I'm a measurement and growth consultant and advisor to ad tech, both on the buy side and the sell side kind of platforms. I've been in ad tech for about 15 years, worked at a number of big tech companies, Google, eBay, Facebook, Netflix, Snap, always kind of looking at marketing analytics, marketing science, and, you know, I've really found a passion and a niche in helping advertisers and helping platforms figure out how to assess the ROI of advertising, digital advertising investment specifically. I think there's a lot of work that the industry has done over the years, but I think there's still a ton of work that needs to be done in that space. And so that's what I'm here to do, to try to help some of those initiatives along.
Really exciting to have you on the podcast, just based on your breadth of experience that you've had on the, let's call it the ad tech vendor side, right? So being on the publisher side with Meta, with Google, with a couple of others. So it sounds like you've kind of done a tour of big tech, if you will, and probably seen a lot of the different ways that media can be bought, sold. But before we dive into kind of some of the specifics that you might want to get into, would love if you could just fill us in on some of the work that you're doing today and maybe the background that you've had that's led you there.
Yeah, for sure. So I recently founded a growth consultancy that we're calling Growth by Science. And a lot of what I do today is really help demystify ads measurement and really contextualize it with respect to some of the privacy changes that have recently come about. So obviously those changes, I'm sure we'll get into it in excruciating depth here, but they've really thrown the ad tech industry for a loop. And I think a lot of folks, both on the platform side, the provider side, and on the growth marketing side, are struggling to find an appropriate path forward and how to assess their marketing measurement. And so a lot of the work that I do at Growth by Science with our clients is help stand up what I call scientific growth programs for growth marketers. And then on the flip side, help ad platforms and solutions really with their go-to-market, how to present a more scientific approach to assessing ads that are on those platforms for their advertising clients. So a lot of math, a lot of statistics, and definitely a lot of strategy on how to navigate that, because I think there's reticence on both sides, on the buy side and on the sell side, to make big changes to the way that things have been done for decades really in digital marketing. Even if there's a catalyst like some of the privacy changes that forces people to rethink some of those old school paradigms.
Yeah, like you said, there's certainly a lot of inertia just based on the way that things have been done historically. But when you take a look at the environment with Growth by Science and you take a look at the kind of established methodology for reporting on conversions or ROI, I think it's probably easy to understand that some of those methods are tried and true, but may not necessarily be as robust to future changes as maybe many marketers think. Could you tell us about some of the most common methods that marketers are using that either today aren't quite as reliable as they may think they are, or might be even less reliable in the future?
Yeah, it's a great point. I will say one thing that I maybe don't fully agree with in your sort of intro to this question is that some of these are tried and true, and maybe privacy is the only thing that is causing them to be less robust. I would say that that while that might be true at the start, the sort of nascence of digital marketing, over the past number of years, call it even decade, a lot of the original ways that we measured ad efficacy have become less and less accurate. And so let me, to explain what I mean by that, let's go back to the beginning and think about, you know, the first ads that were out there. Search ads, right? Banner ads, potentially. But really, it's kind of one of the few places that when you're on your dial-up modem and, you know, it takes 5 seconds for a web page or even longer for a web page to load up, you're going to see a little banner ad there. If it catches your eye, you would have clicked on it and maybe gone and converted somewhere afterwards. You weren't at that time being bombarded with, you know, a plethora of ad platforms on multiple devices. That just wasn't the case. So I think if you go back to those really, really simple times, it kind of made sense that if you clicked on an ad and then subsequently, you know, did something like put in your email address or bought something online, that you could reasonably credit that ad for having elicited that action from you. And so that's kind of what this whole rubric of post-exposure attribution, which is what I like to term sort of this idea of crediting ads that had some kind of interaction with the user that preceded that user's, you know, conversion. That sort of paradigm has gotten more sophisticated over the years. You had, you know, multi-touch attribution, MTA, that kind of played in there. People realized that, hey, people are clicking on multiple different ads, and so maybe it makes sense to credit them in some way. And so you can kind of see where the logic was of like, let's try to give more credit to some ads that maybe introduced a brand to a person and whatnot. But that whole process of entrenching ourselves in this idea of after you see an ad that causes, you know, you can reasonably assume that ad caused you to convert, that sort of caused this feedback loop with the ad platforms that started using those post-exposure signals as objective functions to optimize their ad delivery. And so when you are measuring and optimizing on the same, you know, the same signal type, it's going to give you this rosy picture, this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, which I like to term. And so that's the situation where we're at today, where post-exposure attribution is feeding optimization, delivery optimization, has been on all the major ad platforms. And so they're getting really good at predicting somebody's behavior and then showing ads to people who already are predicted to perform the action that the advertisers care about. And so you're not really understanding the true causality of those ads. And it's really this again, this self-fulfilling prophecy. Now let's talk about privacy, right? So obviously, MTA, multi-touch attribution, you know, requires this sort of idea of a path to purchase, which if you think of what that is in the modern ads ecosystem, it's a series of touch points that the user has had with various ads across multiple devices potentially. So in order to really have that, you need an identifier that can stitch all of those ad exposures together. Privacy changes, ATT, you know, GDPR to a certain extent, CPRA and the various other privacy regulations that are coming up in different states in the U.S., are essentially making that process really, really hard. And sort of the death knell was ATT with Apple's app tracking transparency protocol, where, you know, you can't just by default access the IDFA, the identifier, the mobile identifier. You advertisers can no longer access that without explicit consent on both sides. So the source and the destination of that data. And so that means, long story short, that you can't have reliable path to conversion data sets anymore, and therefore MTA does not work anymore. So let me summarize all this where we're at. MTA was a not causal, bad methodology, even in the context of perfect data. Now it's a not causal methodology with crappy data. So if you combine those two things, is a compounding of errors and uncertainty that really, you know, should make most marketers extremely dubious of anything that is post-exposure, and that includes even platform metrics that are post-exposure. And there's a whole slew of other things we could go on for another hour about why those are now in a shoddy state.
Yeah, and I think you made a couple of really good points there, and I think there's two really that I want to highlight and emphasize, and maybe we can go deeper on both. Number one, you've pointed out that post-exposure attribution, like post-exposure conversions, right? Like that's one element that we just have problems with, number one, right? So the actual conversions that are reported from the ad platforms, we have some problems with that for a variety of different reasons. Interested to dive deeper on that. But then simultaneously, as you note, causality is a really important piece, because if someone was going to come to your website and buy anyway, well, that ad is then getting credit for those. So maybe first, let's talk about what are some of the problems with post-exposure conversion reporting on the platforms themselves. And you've actually had the privilege of working at some of these companies as well. So what's actually happening behind the scenes at Meta, at Google, for example, in ways that you can describe for our audience?
The easiest way to understand this is to look at what ATT and similar protocols for other OSs, what that's preventing. It's essentially preventing conversion signals that happen off the platform, so on an advertiser website, from being linked to an exposure that happened on the platform. So, an ad impression on Instagram or whatever. So because that linkage has been broken, you no longer have this high fidelity exposure conversion data set. So a lot of platforms, and I won't necessarily call any of them out by name, but it's most of them, have this new idea of, hey, we're going to estimate which impressions have had a subsequent conversion with some probability. So they're essentially modeling out conversions that they can't explicitly see from a deterministic perspective anymore. They're estimating whether or not those would have happened. So you combine that with the fact that post-exposure is already an inherently bad methodology, or we can say at best inaccurate, worst flat wrong. You combine that with some kind of modeled behavior, and I've used this analogy before, but it's kind of like you're making up a question, writing an answer to it, and then grading yourself on the question. That's the best analogy to kind of explain the situation that's happening here. So if I'm a marketer right now, I would not at all look at platform first party signals as any objective measure of success of the campaign. I think there is some utility to those signals, and once we kind of talk about where we should go and what are something, we can kind of explain how they might fit in. But anybody that's looking at their CPA on any platform and saying, okay, it's high, therefore it's bad, or it's low, therefore it's good, is missing a ton of context, and probably their campaigns are very far from optimal.
That might come as a shock to some of our listeners that some of the conversions and platforms shouldn't always be trusted, or, many might actually have been dubious of them for quite some time as well. So depending on which side of the fence you're on, you're probably naturally going to be looking for some alternatives. And I know based on my experience in this space, some of the alternatives might be looking at your analytics tool, for example, a Google Analytics, a Piano, a Matomo, an Adobe Analytics, something like this. Or you might be looking at your CRM or your e-commerce receipts, for example, or your orders. Are these tools better, for example, for tracking what your conversions are, especially if you're able to get down to perhaps a last click level?
I would say generally not better. Again, there's some utility to the first party conversion on the platform. There's some utility to what you're getting out of those third party analytics tools. But looking at them in terms of an objective number and trying to associate that back to some kind of post-exposure, whether it's last click or otherwise, that is not going to give you, if you just look at that number as sort of an absolute value, engage your success of your campaign on that, I think that's really going to lead a lot of folks astray. Those third-party analytics software, what they could be good at, determining a relative mix of traffic source, that's something that, data point that you can use. You can look if you have it set up correctly. And by the way, 90% of folks out there don't. But if you do have them set up correctly, they can be useful to look at sort of the volume of the overall volume of conversions. But ultimately, you want to go to the most trustworthy source, which would be, in my opinion, your e-commerce store, like hard dollars in that you're receiving and that you can see showing up in your bank account. That's the ultimate source of truth. And if you start there and then sort of work backwards into where you're willing to sacrifice some trust or insert some fuzziness, I think you'll find that by the time you get to those third-party tools or first-party metrics and ad platforms, you've lost a ton in between there. And so there's this, I think, other paths that can be taken to really understand your marketing performance that don't require a lot of that. They require a mindset shift, but they don't require really granular data and intricate data matching.
Yeah. And that might be a hard truth for some marketers and some businesses where, for example, if you're in the manufacturing space or, for example, food and beverage, you're making products, you're running advertisements, and, well, ultimately, you don't necessarily own that transaction data, right? That's owned by a retailer or potentially a distributor, right? So your success metrics, well, you're either going to have really good relationships, partnerships, or look at something else in the platform realistically to gauge the success of your campaigns in many cases.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say, ironically, the folks that are in those shoes, I think, have been ahead of the curve because they've been forced to look at methodologies that aren't, you know, very data obsessed. People that are digitally native brands, like digitally native brands, over the last few years have had this luxury, obscene luxury of being able to look at so much granular data. And I think they've gone down these rabbit holes of analyzing it and creating, you know, business logic around those path to purchase data sets that they've been able to acquire that I think has actually divorced them from the reality of the true efficacy of those campaigns. Whereas I think of CPGs, they've been doing things like MMM, which I'm sure we'll get into, for decades. And that's been an extremely scientific way to understand, you know, their marketing programs. And that's precisely for the point you brought up, Evan, which is they don't have access to first party sales. They can only, you know, they have to look at potentially getting data back from some of their partners or look at panel-based solutions or have some kind of combination thereof. So, you'd argue that those folks have at least had the right scientific approach to looking at marketing efficacy. And I think now is the time that some of the more modern brands, the folks that have had this data capabilities and the data access, it's time for them to start learning what is tried, tested, and true, and seeing if there's modern ways to apply that to their businesses.
Well, yeah, and I think somewhat counterintuitively, it makes sense because, as we know, constraints tend to breed innovation, right? And if you're constrained by not having that first-party sales data, then you're really kind of forced to look into other methods for assessing the effectiveness of your advertising. Andrew, I'd love to dive into the other half of what you had mentioned. So we know that conversions from platforms and based on what you said, certain analytics tools and a variety of other sources may or may not be as reliable as maybe we had previously thought. The other side of that, which you brought up, which I think is extremely important, is we don't necessarily know, even if there are conversions that are measurable, that are real, were they actually causally influenced by the marketing that we're putting in front of our customers? Let's dive into that a little bit as well. Could you give us a sense of what some of the ways that marketers can start to ask questions around the causality of their marketing might be?
So I think I'll kind of mention an example or a couple of examples that are out there. And again, I won't mention these companies by name, but anybody is welcome to go research this. It's easily findable. There have been over the years a number of massive, massive advertisers that have questioned whether or not massive amounts, I'm talking about hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars of spend on major ad platforms, if they are accretive to their business. And there have been a number of cases over the last 10 years, you know, had part of some of those, where, you know, these advertisers have undergone testing, actual holdout testing. Hey, should we turn these ads off and see what happens? And more often than not, nothing happens. and so you get these scenarios where huge swaths of advertising is just shut off because advertisers are realizing and in the process of doing experimentation, and hopefully, I know I can speak at least for some of these, that they were done in a scientific way, that you don't get incrementality all the time, or the incrementality that you get out of the ad platforms is not always what you expect it to be. And it's certainly never, I can say that with pretty significant confidence, it's almost never what is being displayed in the first party metrics or even in any other post exposure metric. There's a lot of data around this. I've conducted, I don't know how many thousands of tests that has kind of proven the exact same thing, but there's a disparity in post exposure and in true incremental outcomes. So advertisers need to understand that for that reason that I explained earlier, you know, the ad delivery being optimized on post exposure, being measured by post exposure, that is its own alternate reality. That is not at all related to, in most cases, in some cases it can't be, but in 90% of cases, especially with larger advertisers, that is not a true reflection of what the ad campaigns are contributing from an incremental perspective. So let's look at, you know, a field that requires the most rigorous understanding of causality, and it's medicine, right? People's lives are literally at stake. So what do they use? They use design experiments. You know, people have probably heard double-blinded, randomized control trial, placebo-controlled trial. You can do something similar in an ads context. You can't do it on a user level anymore. You could have in more of an ATT day, and we can talk about ad platform incrementality testing in a bit. But for now, let's just say that, you know, that type of testing paradigm is no longer functional. But you can, in most cases, run, especially if you're a larger advertiser, run a geo test, match market test, where you've got controlling ad spend in certain geographies, you're holding it back in others, and you're looking at the relative impact of behavior between those two. Doing something like that, which, by the way, is like a little guarded secret of some of the biggest ad platforms that are out there, that I've worked with most of them, and I can tell you with 100% certainty that advertisers are using geotesting as a foundation of their growth programs. There's differing capabilities in terms of how much you're spending. You can get varying levels of granularity, but I would say out of most of the advertisers that I talk to, talking folks that have six-figure a year budgets to some that have, you know, nine-figure a year budgets, everyone in that range can apply geotesting in some way that gives them a reasonable understanding of the causality of their program. So to answer your question in sort of a long roundabout way, what every advertiser needs to be thinking about is how can I incorporate some type of ground truth experimentation, probably geotesting. How can I incorporate that as some fundamental measure of the efficacy of our ad spend?
This show is brought to you by Supermetrics, the marketing data hub that helps you connect, transform, and export your data to any destination. Over 750,000 marketers worldwide use Supermetrics to turn raw marketing data into business growth. Visit supermetrics.com to find out how.
Andrew, can you maybe walk us through an example of what you might set up in a very naive experimental design, for example? Like if I give you an example and say, I'm an e-commerce company operating in the US and I'm selling subscriptions to, let's say, pencils, right? I'm selling to college students. They need pencils. They need to refresh them frequently. And I need to make sure that I'm getting them out there. I'm advertising online. I'm acquiring customers digitally. What's a good way for me to get started on understanding how effective my advertising is and how causal it might be as well?
I think one of the most powerful tests that any advertiser could run is to look at the overall incrementality of their entire ad program. Obviously, much easier if it's purely digital. Can get a little bit more complicated if there's a different mix and there's some out-of-home or TV or something like that. But let's assume it's mostly digital, you know, mostly addressable digital platforms. So in the example that you described, say it's a national brand working all through the U.S., you know, you'll need to do an analysis of sort of trends and sales by different regions. And there's actually a really great open source tool that ironically Meta has released called Geolift that's a great starting point. But basically what you'll identify, or what this tool can help you identify, is some markets that you're going to designate as test and some markets you'll designate as control. You'll essentially use some linear combination of the control markets to create a modeled version of the test market. And at a certain point in time, you'll do something different to the test market. Either you will light up ads in the test market or you'll turn off ads in the test market, and you will use that control, that model control, we call it a synthetic counterfactual. You'll use that to predict the behavior that should have happened in the test market, all things being equal. And, you know, if you've done something that truly makes an impact on your sales, so say you've turned your advertising off and you've kept it on in the control market, what you will end up seeing is a dip, right? a dip in relative to the predicted modeled out test markets that the control is generating. And that dip will be your incrementality, right? Or, you know, conversely, if you turn ads on and you keep them off, you'll see a jump or something like that. So I think something like that is the easiest first step to do. And I say easiest because it's the one that requires the least amount of math and it's the most easily visualizable. It's still challenging because you still have to, you know, do geo-targeting across all of your channels. You've got to coordinate that. So that can be a pretty hectic experience if you're not using a tool that maybe helps you manage some of that. But in general, it's worth the effort, even if you don't decide to invest in a tool to help you with this. It is worth the effort to do this test at least once a year. I would say at least once a year, and just see what is the incrementality of your overall program. You can get so much value to that too. You can sort of calibrate some of your other models, even if they're not perfect. Like let's say you're using some kind of post-exposure model, you can at least calibrate the total incrementality to be pegged at what you've calculated from that, you know, from that geotest, and then use some of the post-exposure correlative metrics as a relative comparison of channels. I mean, I think it's not perfect, but it's way better than just looking at that in a black box or in a box by itself.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think setting up that initial experiment and getting that experimental design nailed to the point where you have results that you can trust as a business and that you can take forward is probably going to be challenging for some marketers, but it really ends up becoming a paradigm shift in the way that you think about how to measure your ads, right? So you might start with, say, testing your entire program at once, right? Turning all channels black, seeing what that dip ends up being. And once you understand that, and once you've seen that, you know, hey, actually, it seems like our advertising is incremental to X degree, then you can start to contribute additional tests, right? Testing yep. things like, you know, platform level or even creative or message level incrementality. Yep. Is there a reason that you suggest starting with an entire program channel rather than, or an entire program test rather than a channel by channel analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it answers the basic question. Is my marketing working or is it not? And you have two very different roadmaps depending on the outcome of that test. If it's working and working within some margin that feels good or that sort of aligns with the minimum returns that finance is expecting from your marketing, then great. You know that you don't have to make radical shifts to what's out there. You don't have to slam channels off or, you know, drastically change mix. All you have to do is tweak. And the test that you would design in a case where the incrementality is there would be, I would say, pretty different and maybe less aggressive than the ones you would design if it wasn't there. And so like an example, you could instead of turning channels off, you could potentially realign mix a little bit and do a test versus control with that type of experiment. You could have sort of like a business as usual, which is your existing marketing program, and have sort of, you know, challenger type setups that look at something totally different and see if it's like, is there a step change, you know, higher or lower than that business as usual. But you always have something that you know is working that you can revert back to. And again, you should retest that because the market is so dynamic. What's working today might not work in 6 months. So the more frequently you can test these things, the better. But, you know, obviously there's a trade-off in doing too much testing. We can talk about that in a bit. But let's talk quickly about what happens if your marketing is not working, if it's really, really bad, right? I mean, you have the option to shut it all off, right? If it's not incremental, you can turn it off and save money, right? And you know, try to reassess, try to, you know, bring it back to life in a different capacity. And obviously, if it's a massive budget and it's a, you know, the ability to do that is sort of dependent on the size of the business. If it's smaller, maybe it's a little easier to do that. If it's bigger, you might consider doing just more aggressive media mix shifts. You know, promoting some channels, turning others off. You'll probably want to dive into a more granular channel by channel assessment at that point. Typically, spend is concentrated in a few channels for most advertisers. And if overall, you know, digital marketing program is not working, probably those main channels are just not being incremental for you. And so that's not necessarily that those channels don't work at all. It's just maybe you haven't found the right setup to generate incrementality, which is very different than the right setup to generate low CPMs on the platform, right? Or low CPAs on the platform. That's a totally different setup. And that's why when advertisers make the shift to looking at incrementality, oftentimes they will see CPAs spike super high on the platform. And it's a real, you know, brain trip to see that. But you got to ignore that, and you got to focus on incrementality being the North Star.
Right. Yeah, it's probably a very sobering metric, to say the least, for marketers and even for finance teams who might find themselves looking down the barrel of really an effectiveness crisis in many cases, where, you know, historically you thought maybe your CPA for, you know, back to this e-commerce example, you know, acquiring a new customer might be $20, for example, right? And then all of a sudden, when you factor in incrementality, well, it turns out actually if there's significant amounts of latent demand or, you know, strong word of mouth, then perhaps your media is actually closer to pushing a $200 CPA, for example.
Very right? common. Very common.
Any real world examples that you can reference either anonymously or named based on consultations that you've had with customers in Growth by Science, where, you know, you've helped them uncover the fact that maybe their CPA was or their incremental CPA was far higher than what they had originally anticipated?
I work with a subscription product right now where we had this exact same situation. It was assessed by last click, you know, just platform metrics, and everything was rosy, and looked at the reports that were sort of being circulated and raised up to finance. And those CPAs were, you know, modest, certainly lower than the subscription price. So it seemed like things were being acquired at an ROI positive perspective. But it took us a while. It took us a number of months to sort of shift the paradigm from last click to incrementality. And ultimately I convinced them, hey, let's just try this. Let's just, you know, turn off the ads in one of the states and see what happens. And here's the math that we're going to use to figure it out. And it's almost exactly what you described. It went from like a moderate, you know, kind of mid double digit CPA to I think it was actually close to $1,000. That caused, I would say, to say the least, a lot of consternation. But we ended up, and we're still not done with this yet. I'm still working with them to keep chipping away at it. But we were able to have it from an incrementality perspective so far, and it continues to go down. But, you know, if you look at the platform CPAs now, those platform CPAs have tripled or quadrupled in some cases. But yet the incrementality, the what I would call the true CPA, is going down. And so now that we've got everybody aligned to that and we're understanding what are the types of things that we need to focus on. And hint, retargeting is not a typical driver of incrementality. And this particular advertiser was doing a lot of retargeting. And, you know, that's a common sort of place where I would say an incrementality damper is retargeting in many, many cases. It's not in all cases. In some cases it can work, but typically it doesn't. It doesn't really work. So if folks out there that are listening want to, you know, experiment with paring back certain tactics, I would say retargeting and branded search are probably two of the best places to look at from a possible place to shift budget away from.
Right. And based on my experience, looking at branded search and retargeting tend to be two of the, let's call them, highest ROI activities when look at, you know, post-exposure, click-based attribution in many cases, right? So
100%.
Yeah, I think that can be a very interesting revelation for marketers, for example, who are looking at, you know, their CRM or their bank account or their e-commerce site rather than platform reported conversions, and seeing realistically that the numbers don't necessarily change perhaps as much as they would have anticipated.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, those two, if you think about why that's the case for tactics like branded search and retargeting is explicitly out there searching for people who have put something in the basket, expressed intent. They already have a super high likelihood to buy, right? So maybe some of them genuinely do need a little push over the edge, but the way that retargeting works, it doesn't understand. It's not, you know, I would say as precise that it can determine whom out of those people that have expressed intent just need a little push versus who are going to, you know, who are the folks that are going to buy anyway. And so blankets them all, peppers them with, and I'm sure all of us have experienced this. You get, you know, you put something in the cart and boom, 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 buy the shoes. it's the, you know, it kills you with that frequency. And so that's why the CPA looks really, really, really good from a last click perspective or post exposure perspective. And it looks really, really, really bad from an incrementality perspective. Branded search is almost the same thing. You know, typically, when you're looking up a specific brand, you already have some intent, a higher than average intent to visit the site and possibly buy. So again, it looks really good from a last click post-exposure perspective, but really bad from an incrementality perspective. And again, I keep saying, you know, I keep caveating all these things by like, hey, it's not always the case. Just like everything in incrementality measurement, which is statistics based on statistics, there are outliers. There are situations where, you know, it's outside of the mean and things don't operate that way. And that's the same with some of the generalizations that I'm making. So that's why I would encourage everybody that's listening to this, test it out, right? You might have a different situation. And for your particular business, just there could be some nuances that are not, you know, that don't show up in the average marketer's setup. So that's why it's very, very important to test things and, you know, keep saying it again, but test things often and repeat the same test sometimes if you can.
I can imagine that our listeners are going to have a very high degree of urgency to start running some tests after listening to this, especially if this is new information for them as well. For those who have kind of been across the marketing measurement side of things for a while, and particularly those who are working on brands that may not be as fortunate as those who do have access to their first-party sales data. MMM has been a popular technique for, you know, years, you could even say decades, for measuring the effectiveness of marketing. And one of the things you touched on earlier was when you are running these incrementality tests, you can actually use that in conjunction with your MMM program. Could you walk us through what that looks like in your experience?
For sure. MMM is definitely having a moment and has been increasingly so for 2023, maybe a little before. And I think 2024 could be the year of MMM. It really could be the year of MMM. There's a lot of folks that are out there, a lot of measurement providers that have, they began to incorporate MMM into their offerings. And the reason for that is MMM does not require anything except for aggregate data, broken out potentially by some dimensions, depending on how your model is set up. But you don't need to have any kind of complex data exchanges. It's essentially immune from privacy regulations in terms of not needing that granular user-level data. You know, there have also been a lot of advances. Google and Facebook, frankly, have done a lot of that, and other companies too, Uber as well. A lot of folks are really open sourcing the innovations that they've done with respect to MMM methodologies that have made those methodologies a lot more lean, nimbler. You know, you can update the models more frequently. You can actually feed in some calibration sort of points that let the model operate in a better way. And this is all stuff that hasn't really been around in some of the old school MMM models, which are extremely complex. They take a ton of data. The data that they get is delayed oftentimes, and typically they run like once a year, maybe once a quarter. And that was considered like a lean one, is that would run, you know, once a quarter. And this is, I'm talking about more the CPG brands. You can imagine just the volume of data and how disparate it is. It just takes a while to amass it, let alone to crunch out the numbers. And so it's very retrospective and looks back at sort of, you know, performance over the last year. Whereas these newer models can be more forward-looking, they can be predictive, they can really help you with more, you know, granular optimizations. And I mentioned the ability to calibrate these models, and that's sort of a relatively new innovation as well. So using more of a Bayesian model, which allows you to, you know, for lack of a better word, peg the outputs of the MMM to ideally a causal experiment. So you've run a ground truth experiment, you've got some degree of causality, you can plug that in depending on, you know, how you run that experiment. You could plug that into the MMM and make sure that the MMM is taking that into account when it's generating its outputs. And that could be extremely powerful because that means that you don't have to run continuous testing to measure that causality. You can have the MMM, you know, refer back to that experimental result and make sure that as the model's running, it's, you know, it's aligning the outputs to what that result could be. And then, of course, the idea is you would do more testing, you know, regular testing, and continue to feed that model, you know, additional incrementality points and update the ones that you previously have given it. And that way it continues to evolve and stays current with the latest incrementality. So in my view, this is the best of both worlds, where you have the ability to have causal measurement or reasonably close to causal measurement on an ongoing basis through the model. You are still running the experiments, which is the best way to do it, and the results tend to be more actionable. So I'll say there's one other dimension to this, which is if you layer on some post-exposure information, again, not at the at the absolute value level, but in terms of like a relative comparison, you can then incorporate that into the MMM plus the experimental design and the ground truth experiments, and you can start to get results that are broken out at a very, very granular level that are, at the end of the day, rooted in causality. So this is a way to not throw away the baby with the bathwater when it comes to, you know, some of those post-exposure metrics, but you're not looking at them in the wrong way. You're actually extracting probably the only the only piece of utility from them, which is a relative, you know, potentially a relative comparison. You know, I like to call that process triangulation. You know, you're triangulating the experimental, the ground truth experiment, the MMM, and the attribution data, and putting that together in sort of a unified package, which gives you the best of, you know, the best of everything. And I would say the best measurement platforms out there are really leaning into this approach, and are you know, are offering this to their clients. And I really think that the 2024 is the year people wake up to that and understand that, hey, it's worth making the shift to this approach. I can't rely on post-exposure exclusively anymore. It's just leading me astray.
Well, and I think importantly, like you mentioned, it's really three different sides of a comprehensive measurement plan, essentially. And most importantly, it is durable in a privacy-forward environment. You know, I know when I talk to marketers, they have questions today about, well, what's going to happen when cookies go away in Google Chrome, for example. If that does end up happening in 2024, I suppose we'll be wiser maybe next year to see if that ends up being the case. But based on what you said, to a large extent, we're already kind of living in a post-attribution world anyway. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel like we have been for quite some time now, to be honest. But yeah, that's the beauty of this triangulation, you know, approach, is that exactly as you said, it's robust against anything else that happens. Say, all identifiers vanish. IP vanishes. All of this kind of stuff. You're still going to be able to do these types of methodologies. You're still going to be able to apply this triangulation approach, and get some reasonably good results out of it. So it's a lot more robust to you know, the privacy changes that are current and possibly other ones that are upcoming.
Andrew, maybe one last question to wrap things up. I know many marketers will be listening to this, kind of thinking about what their next steps are for conducting incrementality tests. If they are doing MMM, how can they start factoring these into their MMM, either predictions or evaluations? What size of brands should be thinking about this? Is this a big company problem with multi-million dollar budgets, or is this a, you know, problem for small mom and pop shops as well, who are selling online and really need to be thinking about incrementality as they go to market and spend marketing dollars on customer acquisition?
Yeah, I really do think all brands should be thinking, regardless of size, should be considering incrementality, starting at the smallest brands. I think it's not reasonable to say, you know, do a geo holdout if you're, say, a local flower shop. That's just not reasonable. And so in those cases, you have no choice really but to rely on post-exposure metrics. The only thing I would take into consideration if you're at that size is you look at the outputs with a grain of salt and understand that they're not reflective of your true cost of acquiring a customer. You can possibly experiment with doing like on-off type experiments and seeing what happens to your overall sales. But you'll have to kind of be a little bit more hacky if you're really on the smaller side. You're kind of a mid level. This is actually the sweet spot for a lot of this methodology, is sort of that you know, call it, you know, low millions to, you know, mid to high, you know, tens of millions or maybe a little bit higher. That I think is the area of advertisers that are really most affected by this. And if I find that for whatever reason that cohort tends to get, you know, really wrapped up in last click and sort of platform CPA, just because it's easy, they maybe don't always have the resources to build something else up more. And so they're the ones that I think are paying this tax, this, I call it ad tech tax, you know, for acquiring users that they would have acquired anyway. And so if you're in that cohort, I think, you know, really see if you can commit to in 2024 doing a test across all of your media. See what is working and what isn't. or see rather if your whole media program is working and if it isn't. And, you know, this is something that you know, Growth by Science, we're here to help with that. Certainly, we're not the only ones out there. A lot of folks can go to, go to some of the open source programs that are out there from different platforms that I mentioned, apply some of that. But I would really strongly recommend that that is something that that folks prioritize. And then I think, you know, when you're a really, really large brand, typically you're already thinking about this to some extent, although, you know, I've been surprised where maybe that isn't always the case. But it's at that point, you kind of have the luxury of scale where you can be very nuanced with your testing, right? You're typically aware of the overall incrementality. Hopefully you have run a test like that once or twice. Hopefully it's on your regular roadmap. And you can start to get extremely granular about turning off channels in particular countries and things like that to understand from a very nuanced perspective what is driving your incrementality. And again, the MMM is sort of like that bridge between the tests that lets you continue to operate and continues to be updated as you're adding more incrementality data points to your data set.
Andrew's call to action for 2024, start turning stuff off and see what happens is what it sounds like. Andrew, anything else that you'd love for our audience to have before we depart here?
Yeah, the last thing I will say is the stuff that has worked in the past is the stuff that still works now. And it still works now, no matter what media platform you're on. When I recommend media plans for clients of all shapes and sizes, they're always based in reach, in frequency, and in creative, and in great targeting, first-party targeting, none of this targeting that requires combining data sets. If you look at those as the cornerstone of your ad program, I think you're already well on the path to incrementality. And as you test and apply some of the techniques we talked about here today, you'll be able to tune those. Stay away from anything that is post-exposure optimized, that kind of thing tends to not be as incremental as it appears. So test again, and then test once more, and you'll be able to see the truth. Take that red pill, step outside the matrix of the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Thank you, Andrew. Everyone, this has been Andrew and Evan. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you for listening to the Marketing Intelligence Show, brought to you by Supermetrics. If you're enjoying the podcast, then we'd love for you to tap that subscribe button, leave a review, and share with your colleagues and peers. We'll see you in the next episode.